It's a holocaust, visible to us only where it's been painted. She can heal anything with a beating heart, said Reynaldo. Then, please, Bentham said. It's very important that we save this creature's life. Via Reynaldo, Mother Dust issued orders. Take the beast out of the cart, they said. So Emma and I tipped the hologast onto the floor. Put it in the sink, they said. So Emma and Sharon helped me lift it and place it in the basin of the long, deep sink. We cleaned its wounds with water from the tap, careful not to wash away too much of the white paint. Next, Mother Dust examined the hologast as Reynaldo asked me to identify all the places it was hurt. "Now, Marion," Bentham said, addressing Mother Dust informally, "you needn't heal every last cut and bruise. We don't want the creature in top health. We only want to keep it alive, you see?" "Yes, yes," Reynaldo said dismissively. "We know what we are doing." Bentham harumphed and turned his back, making a show of his unhappiness. "Now she will make the dust," Reynaldo said. "Stand back, and be careful not to breathe it in. It will put you to sleep instantly." We backed away. Reynaldo strapped a dust mask over his nose and mouth, and then untied the shawl that wrapped what was left of Mother Dust's right arm. The stump beneath was only a few inches long, and it came to an end well above what would have been her elbow. With her left hand, Mother Dust began to rub the stump, which released a fine white powder that hung in the air. Holding his breath, Reynaldo combed the air with one hand and collected the dust. We watched, fascinated and slightly repulsed, until he'd gathered about an ounce of the stuff, and the size of Mother Dust's stump had been reduced by the same amount. Reynaldo transferred the dust into his mistress's hand. She leaned over the hollow and blew some of it in its face, as I remembered her doing to me. The hollow inhaled, and then jerked suddenly. Everyone but Mother Dust leapt back. "Stay down, stay still," I said, but I needn't have. It was an automatic reaction to the powder, Reynaldo explained, the body downshifting into lower gear. As Mother Dust sprinkled more into the gash on the hollow's neck, Reynaldo told us that the powder could heal wounds and induce sleep, depending on how much was used. As he spoke, a white foam developed around the hollow's wound and began to glow. Mother Dust's dust, Reynaldo said, was her, and of inherently limited quantity. She wore herself away a little every time she healed someone.
"I hope this doesn't seem like a rude question," Emma said. "But why do you do it if it hurts you?"
Mother Dust stopped work on the hollow for a moment, turned so that her good eye could see Emma, and spoke as loudly as we'd ever heard her, in the mushy garble of someone who had no tongue. Reynaldo translated.
"I do it," he said, "because this is how I was chosen to serve."
"Then, thank you," Emma said humbly.
Mother Dust nodded and turned back to her task. The hollow's recovery would not be instantaneous. It was deeply sedated and would wake only after the direst of its wounds had healed, a process that would likely take all night. Because the hollow had to be awake when Bentham plugged it in to his machine, phase two of our rescue plan would have to wait several hours. Until then, most of us were stuck in the kitchen. Reynaldo and Mother Dust, who had to reapply her powder to the hollow's wounds every so often, and Emma and me, because I didn't feel comfortable leaving the hollow alone, even though it was deeply asleep. The hollow was my responsibility now, the way an unhousebroken pet was the responsibility of whoever brought it home. Emma stayed close, too, because I had in some sense become her responsibility,
and she mine, and if I fell asleep, she would tickle me awake, or tell me stories about the good old days in Miss Peregrine's house. Bentham checked in occasionally, but was mostly off doing security sweeps of the house with Sharon and Nim, paranoid that his brother's foot soldiers might attack at any time. As the night wore on, Emma and I talked about what the coming day might hold. Assuming Bentham could get his machine working again, it was possible that in a matter of hours we would find ourselves inside the White's fortress. We might see our friends again, and Miss Peregrine.
"If we're very sneaky, and very, very lucky," Emma said, "and if..."
She hesitated. We were sitting side by side on a long wooden bench against a wall, and now she shifted so that I couldn't see her face.
"What?"
I said. She looked back at me, her face pained.
"If they're still alive."
"They are."
"No, I'm tired of pretending. By now the Whites could have harvested their souls for ambrosia, or realized the Imbrans are useless and decided to torture them instead, or milk their souls, or made an example of someone for trying to escape."
"Stop it," I said. "It hasn't been that long."
"By the time we get there, it'll have been 48 hours at least, and a lot of awful things can happen in 48 hours.
"We don't have to imagine every single one of them. You sound like Horace with all these worst-case scenarios. There's no use tormenting ourselves until we know for sure what's happened."
"Yes, there is," she insisted. "There's a perfectly good reason to torment ourselves. If we've considered all the worst possibilities and one turns out to be true, we won't be completely unprepared for it."
"I don't think I could ever prepare myself for those kinds of things." She put her head in her hands and let out a shaky sigh. It was all too much to think about. I wanted to tell her then that I loved her. I thought that might help, by grounding us in something we were sure about, rather than everything we weren't, but we hadn't said the words to each other many times, and I couldn't bring myself to say them now in front of two perfect strangers. The more I thought about loving Emma, the shakier and sicker it made me feel, precisely because our future was so uncertain. I needed to imagine a future for myself with Emma in it, but it was impossible to picture our lives even a day from now. It was a constant struggle for me, having no idea what tomorrow held. I'm cautious by nature, a planner, someone who likes to know what's around the next corner and the corner after that, and this entire experience, from the moment I ventured into the abandoned shell of Miss Peregrine's house to now, had been one long free fall into the void. To survive it, I'd had to become a new person, someone flexible and sure-footed and brave, someone my grandfather would have been proud of. But my transformation had not been total. This new Jacob was grafted onto the old one, and I still had moments, plenty of them, of abject terror, and wishing I'd never heard of any damned Miss Peregrine, and needing very badly for the world to stop spinning, so I could just hang on to something for a few minutes. I wondered, with a sinking ache, which Jacob loved Emma. Was it the new one, who was ready for anything, or the old one, who just needed something to hang on to? I decided that I didn't want to think about it right now, a distinctly old Jacob way of handling things, and focused instead on the distraction nearest at hand, the hollow, and what would happen when it woke. I would have to give him up, it seemed.
"I wish I could take him with us," I said. "He would make it so easy to smash anyone who got in our way.
but I guess he has to stay behind to keep the machine running. So, it's a him now? She raised an eyebrow. Don't get too attached. Remember, if you gave that thing half a chance, it would eat you alive.
I know, I said, sighing.
And maybe it wouldn't be so easy to smash everything. I'm sure the Whites know how to handle hollows. After all, they used to be hollows.
It's a unique gift you have, said Reynaldo, speaking to us for the first time in over an hour.
He had taken a break from monitoring the hollow's wound to rummage through Bentham's cabinets for food, and now he and Mother Dust were seated at a small table, sharing a block of blue-veined cheese.
It's a strange gift, though, I said. I'd been thinking about how strange it was for a while, but hadn't quite been able to articulate it until now. In an ideal world, there wouldn't be any hollows, and if there weren't any hollows, my special sight would have nothing to see, and no one would understand the weird language I can speak. You wouldn't even know I had a peculiar ability.
Then it's a good thing you're here now, Emma said. Yeah, but doesn't it seem almost too random? I could have been born any time. My grandfather, too. Hollows have existed for only the last 100 years or so. But it just so happens that we were both born now, right when we were needed. Why?
I guess it was meant to be, Emma said. Or maybe there have always been people who can do what you do, only they never knew it. Maybe lots of people go through life never knowing they're peculiar.
Mother Dust leaned toward Reynaldo and whispered.
She says it's neither, said Reynaldo. Your true gift probably isn't manipulating Hologast. That's just its most obvious application.
What do you mean? I said. What else could it be? Mother Dust whispered again.
It's simpler than that, said Reynaldo. Just as someone who's a gifted cellist wasn't born with an aptitude for only that instrument, but for music in general, you weren't born only to manipulate hollows. Nor you, he said to Emma, to make fire.
Emma frowned. I'm over 100 years old. I think I know my own peculiar ability by now, and I definitely can't manipulate water or air or dirt. Believe me, I've tried.
That doesn't mean you can't, Reynaldo said. Early in life we recognize certain talents in ourselves, and we focus on those to the exclusion of others. It's not that nothing else is possible, but that nothing else was nurtured.
It's an interesting theory, I said.
The point is, it's not so impossibly random that you have a talent for hologast manipulation. Your gift developed in that direction because that's what was needed.
If that's true, then why can't all of us control hollows? Emma said. Every peculiar could use some of what Jacob's got.
Because only his basic talent was capable of developing that way. In the times before hollows, the talents of peculiars with souls akin to his probably manifested some other way. It's said that the Library of Souls was staffed by people who could read peculiar souls like they were books. If those librarians were alive today, perhaps they'd be like him.
Why do you say that? I said. Is there something about seeing hollows that's like reading souls?
Reynaldo conferred with Mother Dust. You seem to be a reader of hearts, he said. You saw some good in Bentham's, after all. You chose to forgive him.
Forgive him? I said. What would I have to forgive him for?
Mother Dust knew she'd said too much, but it was too late to hold back. She whispered to Reynaldo.
for what he did to your grandfather, he said.
I turned to Emma, but she seemed just as confused as I was. And what did he do to my grandfather?
I'll tell them, said a voice from the doorway, and then Bentham hobbled in by himself. It's my shame, and I should be the one to confess it.
He shuffled past the sink, pulled a chair away from the table, and sat down facing us.
During the war, your grandfather was highly valued for his special facility with Hollows. We had a secret project, some technologists and I. We thought we could replicate his ability and give it to other peculiars. Inoculate them against Hollows like a vaccine. If we could all see and sense them, they would cease to be a threat, and the war against their kind would be won. Your grandfather made many noble sacrifices, but none so great as this. He agreed to participate.
Emma's face was tense as she listened. I could see she'd never heard any of this before.
We took just a little bit, Bentham said. Just a piece of his second soul. We thought it could be spared, or would be replenished, like when someone gives blood.
You took his soul, Emma said, her voice wavering.
Bentham held his finger and thumb a centimeter apart.
This much.
We split it up and administered it to several test subjects. Although it had the desired effect, it didn't last long. And repeated exposure began to rob them of their native abilities. It was a failure.
And what about Abe? Emma said.
In her tone was the special malice she reserved for those who hurt people she loved.
What did you do to him?
He was weakened, and his talent diluted, said Bentham. Before the procedure, he was much like young Jacob. His ability to control Hollows was a deciding factor in our war with the whites. After the procedure, however, he found he couldn't control them any longer, and his second sight became blurred. I'm told that soon afterward, he left peculiardom altogether. He worried he would be a danger to his fellow peculiars rather than a help. He felt he could no longer protect them.
I looked at Emma. She was staring at the floor, her face unreadable.
A failed experiment is nothing to be sorry for, Bentham said. It's how scientific progress is made. But what happened to your grandfather is one of the great regrets of my life.
That's why he left, Emma said, her face tilting upward. It's why he went to America.
She turned to me. She didn't look angry, but wore an expression of dawning relief.
He was ashamed. He said so in a letter once, and I never understood why. That he felt ashamed and unpeculiar.
It was taken from him, I said. Now I had an answer to another question. How a Hollowgast could have bested my grandfather in his own backyard. He wasn't senile, or even particularly frail. But his defenses against Hollows were mostly gone, and had been for a long time.
That's not what you should be sorry for, said Sharon, standing in the doorway with his arms crossed. One man wasn't going to win that war. The real shame is what the whites did with your technology. You created the precursor to Ambrosia.
I've tried to repay my debt, Bentham said.
Didn't I help you? And you?
He looked at Sharon, and then Mother Dust. Like Sharon, it seemed she, too, had been an Ambro addict.
For years, I've wanted to apologize, he said, turning to me. To make it up to your grandfather. That's why I've been looking for him all this time.
I hoped he would come back to see me, and I might figure out a way to restore his talent.
Emma laughed bitterly.
After what you did to him, you thought he'd come back for more?
I didn't consider it likely, but I hoped. Fortunately, redemption comes in many forms. In this case, in the guise of a grandson.
I'm not here to redeem you, I said.
Nevertheless, I am your servant. If I can do anything, it is yours for the asking.
Just help us get our friends back, and your sister.
Gladly, he said, seeming relieved I hadn't demanded more or stood up and screamed in his face. I still might have. My head was spinning, and I hadn't quite sorted out how to react.
Now, he said, as for how to proceed from here.
Can we have a moment? Emma said. Just Jacob and me.
We exited into the hall to talk in private, out of sight of the hollow, but only just.
Let's make a list of all the terrible things this man is responsible for, Emma said.
Okay, I said. 1. He created hollows. Without meaning to, though.
But he did. And he created ambrosia. And he took away Abe's power, or most of it.
Without meaning to, I nearly said again, but Bentham's intentions were beside the point. I knew what she was getting at. After all these revelations, I wasn't so confident about putting our fates and those of our friends in Bentham's hands, or his plans. He may have been well-meaning, but he had a dismal track record.
"Can we trust him?" Emma said.
Do we have a choice?
That wasn't my question.
I thought for a moment. I think we can, I said. I just hope he's used up all his bad luck.
Come quickly! It's waking up!
Shouts echoed from the kitchen. Emma and I dashed through the doorway to find everyone cowering in a corner, terrified of a groggy hologast that was struggling to sit up, but had managed only to droop its upper body over the edge of the sink. Only I could see its open mouth, its tongues lolling limply across the floor.
"Close your mouth," I said in hollow. Making a sound like it was slurping spaghetti, it sucked them back into its jaws.
"Sit up." The hollow couldn't quite do it, so I took it by the shoulders and guided it into a seated position. It was recovering with remarkable speed, though, and after another few minutes it had regained enough motor skill to be coaxed out of the sink and onto its feet. It no longer limped. All that was left of the gash in its neck was a faint white line, not unlike the ones fast disappearing from my own face. As I relayed this, Bentham couldn't hide his irritation that Mother Dust had healed the hollow so thoroughly.
"Can I help it if my dust is potent?" Mother Dust said via Reynaldo.
Exhausted, they went off to find beds. Emma and I were tired, too. It was nearing dawn and we hadn't slept, but the progress we were making was exciting, and hope had given us a second wind. Bentham turned to us, eyes alight.
"Moment of truth, friends. Shall we see if we can get the old girl running again?"
By that he meant his machine, and there was no need to ask.
"Let's not waste another second," Emma said.
Bentham summoned his bear, and I rallied my hologast. P.T. appeared in the doorway, scooped his master into his arms, and together they led us through the house. What a strange sight we would have made, had anyone been watching. A dapper gentleman cradled in the arms of a bear, Sharon in his billowing black cloak, Emma stifling yawns with a hand that kept smoking, and plain old me,
muttering at my white-daubed hologast, who even in perfect health shuffled as he walked, as if his bones didn't quite fit his body. Through the halls and down the stairs we went, into the bowels of the house, rooms crowded with clanking machinery, each smaller than the last, until finally we came to a door that the bear couldn't fit through. We stopped. P.T. set his master down.
"Here it is," Bentham said, beaming like a proud father. "The heart of my Panlupticon."
Bentham opened the door. P.T. waited outside while the rest of us followed him in. The small room was dominated by a fearsome machine made of iron and steel. Its guts stretched from wall to wall, a baffling array of flywheels and pistons and valves glistening with oil. It looked like a machine capable of making unholy noise, but for now it sat cold and silent. A greasy man stood between two giant gears, tightening something with a wrench.
"This is my assistant, Kim," said Bentham.
I recognized him. He was the man who'd chased us out of the Siberia room. "I'm Jacob," I said. "We surprised you in the snow yesterday."
"What were you doing out there?" Emma asked him.
"Freezing half to death," the man said bitterly, and he went on wrenching.
"Kim's been helping me search for a way into my brother's Panlupticon," said Bentham. "If such a door exists in the Siberia room, it's likely at the bottom of a deep crevasse. I'm certain Kim will be grateful if your hologast succeeds in bringing some of our other rooms online, but there are sure to be doors in more accessible places."
Kim grunted, his face skeptical as he looked us up and down. I wondered how many years he'd spent battling frostbite and combing the crevasses. Bentham got down to business. He issued clipped orders to his assistant, who twisted a few dials and pulled a long lever. The gears of the machine gave a hiss and sputter, then turned a degree.
"Bring in the creature," Bentham said in a low voice.
The hollow had been waiting outside, and I called him in. He shuffled through the doorway and let out a low, gravelly growl, as if he knew something unpleasant was about to happen to him. The assistant dropped his wrench, but quickly retrieved it.
"Here is the battery chamber," Bentham said, drawing our attention to a large box in the corner. "You must guide the creature inside, where he'll be restrained."
The chamber resembled a windowless phone booth made of cast iron. A nest of tubes sprouted from its top and connected to pipes that ran along the ceiling. Bentham grasped the heavy door's handle and pulled it open with a grating rasp. I peered inside. The walls were smooth gray metal perforated with small holes, like the interior of an oven. Along the back hung a collection of thick leather straps. "Will it hurt him?" I asked. I surprised myself with the question, and Bentham too.
"Does that matter?" he replied.
"I'd rather it didn't, if we have a choice."
"We don't," Bentham said. "But it won't feel any pain. The chamber fills with anesthetic sleeping gas before anything else happens."
"And then what?" I said. He smiled and patted my arm.
"It's very technical. Suffice to say, your creature will leave the chamber alive, in more or less the condition he entered it. Now, if you would kindly have it step inside."
I wasn't sure I believed him, nor why it mattered to me. The hollows had put us through hell and seemed so lacking in feeling that inflicting pain on them should have been a pleasure. But it wasn't. I didn't want to kill the hollow any more than I wanted to kill a strange animal. In the course of leading this creature around by the nose, I had gotten close enough to understand that there was more than just void inside it. There was a tiny spark, a little marble of soul at the bottom of a deep pool. It wasn't hollow, not really.
"Come,"
I said to it, and the hollow, which had been lurking shyly in the corner, stepped around Bentham to stand before the booth.
"Inside."
I felt it waver. It was healed now, and strong, and if my hold on it faltered for even a moment, I knew what it might do. But I was stronger, and a battle of wills between us would have been no contest. It wavered, I think, because I had.
"I'm sorry," I said to it.
The hollow didn't move. Sorry was input it didn't know what to do with. I just needed to say it.
"Inside," I said again.
And this time the hollow complied and stepped into the chamber. Since no one else would touch it, from that point Bentham told me what to do. For his instructions, I pushed the hollow against the back wall and crossed the leather straps over its legs, arms, and chest, buckling them tight. They were clearly designed to restrain a human being, which raised questions to which I didn't want the answers right now. All that mattered was moving forward with the plan. I stepped out, feeling stifled and panicky from the few moments I'd spent inside.
"Close the door," Bentham said.
When I hesitated, the assistant moved to do it, but I blocked his way. "It's my hollow," I said. "I'll do it." I planted my feet and grabbed the handle, and then, though I tried not to, looked into the hollow's face. Its great black eyes were wide and frightened, all out of proportion with its body, small and shriveled like a cluster of figs. It was still, and would always be, a disgusting creature, but it looked so pathetic that I felt unaccountably terrible, like I was about to put to sleep a dog who didn't understand why it was being punished. All hollowghast need to die, I told myself. I knew I was right, but it didn't make me feel any better. I pulled on the door, and it screamed shut. Bentham's assistant hooked a giant padlock through its handles, then went back to the machine's controls and began twiddling dials.
"You did the right thing,"
Emma whispered in my ear. Gears began to turn, pistons to pump, the machine itself to thrum with a rhythm that shook the entire room. Bentham clapped his hands and grinned, happy as a school kid. Then, from inside the chamber, came a scream the likes of which I'd never heard.
"You said it wouldn't hurt him!"
I shouted at Bentham. He turned to shout at his assistant.
"The gas! You forgot the anesthesia!"
The assistant scrambled to pull another lever. There was a loud hiss of compressed air. A wisp of white smoke curled from a crack in the chamber door. The hollow's screams gradually faded.
"There," said Bentham. "Now it feels nothing."
I wished for a moment that Bentham was in that chamber instead of my hollow. Other pieces of the machine came alive. There was the sound of liquid sloshing through the pipes above our heads. Several small valves near the ceiling rang like bells. Black fluid began dripping down through the machine's guts. It wasn't oil, but something even darker and more pungent. The fluid that the hollowghast produced almost constantly, that wept from its eyes and dripped from its teeth. Its blood. I'd seen enough, and walked out of the room feeling sick to my stomach. Emma followed me.
"Are you okay?"
I couldn't expect her to understand my reaction. I hardly understood it myself.
"I'll be fine," I said. "This is the right thing."
"It's the only thing," she said. "We're so close."
Bentham hobbled out of the room.
"P.T., upstairs," he said,
and he tipped himself into the bear's waiting arms.
"Is it working now?" Emma said.
"We're going to find out," Bentham replied. With my hollow restrained, sedated, and locked inside an iron chamber, there was little danger in leaving him behind, and yet I lingered by the door.
"Sleep," I said. "Sleep. And don't wake up until this is over."
I followed the others out through the machine rooms and up several flights of stairs. We came to the long carpeted hallway that was lined with exotically named rooms. The walls hummed with energy. The house seemed alive. P.T. set Bentham on the carpet.
"Moment of truth," he said.
He marched to the nearest door and flung it open. A humid breeze blew into the hall. I stepped forward to look inside. What I saw gave me goosebumps. Like the Siberia room, it was a portal to another time and place. The room's simple furniture, bed, wardrobe, side table, was caked with sand. The rear wall was missing. Beyond it was a curving, palm-fringed beach.
"I give you Rarotonga 1752," Bentham declared proudly. "Hello, Sammy! Long time!"
Squatting in the near distance was a small man cleaning a fish. He regarded us with mild surprise, then raised the fish and waved to us with it.
"Long time," he agreed.
"This is good, then," Emma said to Bentham. "This is what you wanted?"
"What I wanted? What I've been dreaming of?"
Bentham laughed as he hurried off to throw open another door. Inside was a yawning, tree-filled canyon, a narrow bridge suspended across it.
"British Columbia, 1929!
He crowed. He pirouetted down the hall to open a third door. By now we were chasing him, inside which I could see hulking stone pillars, the dusty ruins of an ancient city.
"Palimra!"
he shouted, slapping his hand against the wall.
"Huzzah! The damned thing works!"
Bentham could hardly contain himself.
"My beloved Panlupticon!" he cried,
throwing his arms wide.
"How I missed you!"
"Congratulations," Sharon said. "I'm glad I could be here to witness this."
Bentham's excitement was infectious. It was an astounding thing, his machine, a universe contained in a single hallway. Looking down it, I could see hints of other worlds peeking out, wind moaning behind one door, grains of sand blowing into the hall from beneath another. At any other time, under any other circumstances, I would have run and thrown them open. But right now, there was only one door I cared about opening. "Which of these leads inside the White's Fortress?" I asked.
"Yes, yes, to business," Bentham said,
reining himself in.
"My apologies if I got a bit carried away. I've put my life into this machine, and it's good to see it up and running again."
He leaned against a wall, suddenly sapped of energy.
"Getting you into the fortress should be a simple enough proposition. Behind these doors are at least a half dozen crossover points. The question is, what will you do once you get there?"
"That depends," Emma said.
"What are we going to find when we get there?"
It's been a long time since I was inside, Bentham said. So my knowledge is dated. My brother's panopticon doesn't look like mine. It is arranged vertically in a high tower. The prisoners are kept elsewhere. They'll be in separate cells, under heavy guard.
The guards will be our biggest problem, I said.
I may be able to help with them, said Sharon.
You're coming with us? Emma said.
Absolutely not, Sharon said. But I'd like to do my bit somehow, with minimal risk to myself, of course. I'll create a disturbance outside the fortress walls that will draw the guards' attention. That should make it easier for you to skulk about unnoticed.
What kind of disturbance? I asked.
The White's least favorite kind, a civil one. I'll get those layabouts on Smoking Street to catapult nasty, flaming things at the walls until we've got the whole guard force after us.
And why would they help you? Emma said.
Because there's lots more where this came from.
He reached into his cloak and pulled out the vial of Ambro he'd snatched from Emma.
Promise them enough of it, and they'll do just about anything.
Put it away, sir! Bentham snapped. You know I don't allow that in my house!
Sharon apologized and stuffed the vial back into his cloak. Bentham consulted his pocket watch.
Now, it's just after 4:30 in the morning. Sharon, I imagine your disturbers of the peace are asleep. Could you have them riled and ready by 6?
Absolutely, Sharon said.
Then see to it.
Happy to be of service.
And with a swoosh of his cloak, Sharon turned and hurried away down the hall.
That gives you an hour and a half to prepare, Bentham said,
though it wasn't immediately clear what preparations could be made.
Anything I have is at your disposal.
Think, Emma said, what would be useful in a raid?
Do you have any guns? I asked. Bentham shook his head.
PT here is all the protection I need.
Explosives? Emma said.
I'm afraid not.
I don't suppose you have an Armageddon chicken, I said, only half kidding.
A stuffed one, among my displays.
I imagined throwing a stuffed chicken at a gun-toting white, and wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry.
Perhaps I'm confused, Bentham said. Why would you need guns and explosives when you can control hollows? There are many inside the fortress. Tame them and the battle is won.
It's not that easy, I said, weary of explaining. It takes a long time to take control of even one.
My grandfather could have done it, I wanted to say, before you broke him.
Well, that's your business, Bentham said, sensing he'd stepped on my toes. However you accomplish it, the Imbrins must be your priority. Bring them back first, as many as you can, starting with my sister. They're the most wanted, the biggest prize, and they're in the worst danger.
I agree with that, Emma said. Imbrins first, then our friends.
And then what? I said.
Once they notice we're stealing back our peculiars, they're going to come after us. Where do we go from here?
It was like robbing a bank. Getting the money was only half the job. Then you had to get away with the money.
Go anywhere you like, Bentham said, gesturing down the length of the hall.
Pick any door, any loop. You have 87 potential escape routes in this hallway alone.
He's right, Emma said. How would they ever find us?
I'm sure they'd find a way, I said. This will only slow them down.
Bentham held up a finger to stop me.
Which is why I'll lay a trap for them, and make it look as if we've hidden ourselves in the Siberia room. PT has a large extended family there, and they'll be waiting just inside the door, good and hungry.
And if the bears can't finish them off, Emma said.
Then I suppose we'll have to, said Bentham.
And Bob's your uncle, Emma said, a Britishism that would have been incomprehensible if not for her sarcastic tone of voice. Translation, your nonchalant attitude strikes me as insane. Bentham spoke as if the whole thing were no more complicated than a trip to the grocery store. Storm in, rescue everyone, hide, finish off the bad guys, and Bob's your uncle. Which was, of course, insane. You realize we're just two people, I said. Two kids.
Yes, exactly,
Bentham said, nodding sagely.
That's to your advantage. If the whites are expecting resistance of any kind, it's an army at their gates, not a couple of children in their midst.
His optimism was beginning to wear me down. Maybe, I thought, we did have a chance.
Hello there!
We turned to see Nim running down the hall toward us, panting for breath.
Bird for Mr. Jacob, he called. Messenger bird, for Mr. Jacob. Just winged in. Waiting downstairs.
Upon reaching us, he doubled over and launched into a coughing fit. How could I have a message? I said. Who even knows I'm here?
We'd better find out, said Bentham. Nim, lead the way.
Nim fell over in a heap.
Oh, Lord, said Bentham.
We're getting you a calisthenics trainer, Nim. P.T., give the poor man a lift.
The messenger was waiting in a foyer downstairs. It was a large green parrot. It had flown into the house through an open window several minutes before and begun squawking my name, at which point Nim had caught it and put it in a cage. It was still squawking my name.
Jacob! Jacob!
Its voice sounded like a rusty hinge.
He won't talk to anyone but you,
Nim explained, hurrying me toward the cage.
Here he is, you silly bird! Give him the message!
Hello, Jacob,
the parrot said.
This is Miss Peregrine speaking.
What?
I said, shocked. She's a parrot now?
No, Emma said. The message is from Miss Peregrine. Go ahead, parrot. What does she say?
I'm alive and well in my brother's tower, said the bird,
speaking now in an eerily human-sounding voice.
The others are here, too. Millard, Olive, Horace, Bruntley, Enoch, and the rest.
Emma and I glanced at one another. Bruntley? Like a living answering machine, the bird went on.
Miss Wren's dog told me where I might find you. You and Miss Bloom. I want to dissuade you from any rescue attempts. We are in no danger here, and there's no need to risk your life with silly stunts. Instead, my brother has made this offer. Give yourselves up to his guards at the Smoking Street Bridge, and you won't be harmed. I urge you to comply. This is our only option. We will be reunited, and under my brother's care and protection, we'll all be part of the new peculiardom.
The parrot whistled, indicating the message was over. Emma was shaking her head.
That didn't sound like Miss Peregrine, unless she's been brainwashed.
And she never calls the kids by only their first or last names, I said. That would have been Miss Bruntley.
You don't believe the message is authentic, Bentham said.
I don't know what that was, Emma replied.
Bentham leaned toward the cage and said,
Authenticate!
The bird said nothing. Bentham repeated his command, wary, and cocked his ear toward the bird. Then suddenly, he straightened.
Oh, hell!
And then I heard it too. Ticking.
Bomb!
Emma screamed. P.T. knocked the cage into a corner, swept us into a protective embrace, and turned his back to the bird. There was a blinding flash and a deafening bang, but I felt no pain. The bear had taken the brunt of the blast. Other than a pressure wave that popped my ears and blew off Bentham's hat, followed by a searing but mercifully brief sensation of heat, we'd been spared. It was raining paint flakes and parrot feathers as we stumbled out of the room. We were all unscathed but the bear, who sank onto all fours and showed us his back with a trembling whimper. It was seared black and stripped of fur, and when Bentham saw it, he cried out in anger and hugged the animal by its neck. Nim ran off to wake Mother Dust.
"Do you know what this means?"
Emma said. She was shaking, eyes wide. I'm sure I looked the same. Surviving a bomb attack will do that to a person. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Miss Peregrine who sent that parrot, I said.
Obviously.
And Carl knows where we are.
If he didn't before, he does now. Messenger birds are trained to find people even if the sender doesn't have their exact address.
It definitely means he caught Addison, I said, my heart sinking at the thought.
Yes, but it means something else, too. Cole's scared of us. He wouldn't have bothered trying to kill us otherwise.
Maybe, I said.
Definitely. And if he's scared of us, Jacob...
She narrowed her eyes at me.
That means there's something to be scared of.
He isn't frightened, said Bentham, lifting his head from the folds of P.T.'s neck. He should be, but he isn't. That parrot wasn't meant to kill you, only to incapacitate. It seems my brother wants young Jacob alive.
Me? I said. What for?
I can think of only one reason. Word of your performance with the Hologast reached him, and it convinced him you're quite special.
Special how? I said.
My hunch is this. He believes you may be the last key to the Library of Souls, one who can see and manipulate the soul jars.
Like Mother Dust said,
whispered Emma.
That's crazy, I said.
Could it be true?
All that matters is that he believes it, said Bentham. But it changes nothing. You'll execute the rescue as planned, and then we'll get you, your friends, and our Imbrins as far from my brother and his mad schemes as possible. But we must hurry. Jack's foot soldiers will trace the exploded parrot to this house. They'll be coming for you shortly. And you must be gone before they arrive.
He consulted his pocket watch.
Speaking of which, it's nearly 6 o'clock.
We were about to go, when Mother Dust and Reynaldo rushed in.
Mother Dust would like to give you something, he said,
and Mother Dust held out a small object wrapped in cloth. Bentham told them we had no time for gifts, but Reynaldo insisted.
In case you run into trouble, he said,
pressing the item into Emma's hand.
Open it.
Emma peeled back the rough cloth. The small thing inside looked at first like a stub of chalk, until Emma rolled it in her palm. It had two knuckles and a small painted nail. It was a pinky finger.
You shouldn't have, I said.
Reynaldo could see we didn't understand.
It's Mother's finger, he said. Crush it up and use it as you will.
Emma's eyes widened, and her hand dropped a little, as if the finger had just tripled in weight.
I can't accept this, she said. It's too much.
Mother Dusk reached out with her good hand. It was smaller than before, a bandage covering the knuckle where her pinky used to be, and closed Emma's hand around the gift. She mumbled, and Reynaldo translated.
You and he might be our last hope. I'd give you my whole arm if I could spare it.
I don't know what to say, I said. Thank you.
Use it sparingly, Reynaldo said. A little goes a long way. Oh, and you'll want these.
He pulled two dust masks from his back pocket and dangled them.
Otherwise, you'll put yourselves to sleep along with your enemies.
I thanked him again and accepted the masks. Mother Dust gave us a little bow, her enormous skirt dusting the floor.
And now we really must be going, Bentham said,
and we left P.T. in the company of the healers and the two bear cubs, who had come in to snuggle their ailing elder. We returned upstairs to the Hall of Loops. When we came off the landing, I felt a brief whirl of vertigo, a sudden cliff's edge dizziness in recognition of where I was standing, 87 worlds behind 87 doors, all stretching out before us, all those infinities connecting back here like nerves to a brainstem. We were about to go into one, and maybe never come out again. I could feel old Jacob and new Jacob wrestling over that, terror and exhilaration coming at me in successive waves. Bentham was talking, walking quickly with his cane, telling us which door to use and where to find the door inside that door that would cross over to Call's side of the loop, and how to get out again into the Panlupticon machine inside Call's stronghold. It was all very complicated, but Bentham promised that the route was short and marked with signs. To make doubly sure we didn't get lost, he'd send along his assistant to guide us. The assistant was summoned from tending the machine's gears, and stood grim and silent while we said goodbye. Bentham shook our hands.
Goodbye, good luck, and thank you, he said.
Don't thank us yet, Emma replied.
The assistant opened one of the doors and waited beside it.
Bring back my sister, Bentham said, and when you find the ones who have her...
He raised his gloved hand and made a fist with it, the leather creaking as it tightened.
Don't spare their feelings.
We won't, I said, and walked through the doorway. Chapter 7 We followed Bentham's assistant into the room, past the usual furnishings, through the missing fourth wall, and out into a thick grove of evergreens. It was midday, late fall or early spring, the air chill and tinged with wood smoke. Our feet crunched along a well-worn path, the only other sounds a songbird's whistle and the low but rising roar of falling water. Bentham's assistant said little, and that was fine by us. Emma and I were filled with a high, buzzing tension, and had no interest in idle conversation. We passed through the trees and out onto a track that curved around a mountainside, a desaturated landscape of gray rocks and patches of snow. Distant pines like rows of bristling brushes. We jogged at a moderate pace, careful not to exhaust ourselves too soon. After a few minutes we rounded a bend and found ourselves standing before a thundering waterfall. Here was one of the signs Bentham had promised. This way, it read, plain as day.
Where are we? Emma asked.
Argentina, the assistant replied.
Obeying the sign, we followed a path that became gradually overgrown with trees and thickets. We pushed aside the brambles and trudged on, the waterfall quieting behind us. The path ended at a small stream.